Okay, listen, I gotta go back. But gotta go to the bathroom really bad. Because if this was radio, I would just go without you guys knowing it.
Yeah, it's a little, I mean, you could go immune and turn off your camera, but then we'd be like, what happened to Tom and where'd he go?
Right.
So then we'll let
you can't see what I'm doing now, so I'm going to the bathroom.
This is amazing, Tommy. Didn't know we're well, Tommy Chung came with us on camera. This is amazing.
I had an operation. You know, I'm old anyway. And I had this operation, plumbing operation, where they rearranged my plumbing.
Yeah.
And so I've got no ability to hold it. Like, you know, girls can be like camels, you know, they can walk across the desert without going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
You know, well, I can't anymore.
But it is harder for men to hold it.
I'll be polite. I'll flush it later.
Oh, okay. I do it with Chrissy when we're on the phone.
Exactly.
Our planet is a lonely speck in the great cosmic dark.
Hi, this is Chrissy.
And I'm Marie.
And you're listening to Alt Pop Repeat,
a show where we get into the nitty-gritty around counterculture, alternative culture, and sync it up with what?
With pop culture.
Yeah, man. That's what we do.
There we go.
High five. Yes.
So I say things like jive, devil's lettuce, reefer. What am I referring to, Marie?
You're referring to, obviously, cannabis, duh.
Well, some people might not know that. Did you know that there is over 2,300 slang words? There's fine stuff, the flower. There's dew, ace, airplane, ashes. Like, there's so many.
Joint, 420, pot, Mary Jane.
So then who is our celebrity guest today, Marie?
Well, I mean, so our celebrity guest today is the incomparable Tommy Chong, who is cool because not only is he pop culture significant,
yes,
but he is also significant from a counterculture perspective and also from a political standpoint.
Yeah, he's an activist, he's an actor, he's a comedian, he's a writer, he's a director, he's a musician. He's everything. And everybody knows him mainly from Cheech and Chong, or the comedy duo Cheech and Chong. And also most recently, I would say for most people that are from our generation and even a little bit younger would know him from That 70s Show. He was the guy that had the photo booth and was the the pothead in the photo booth. So today, Tommy Chong is our guest on I'll Pop Repeat. And we talk everything about activism when he was in jail. Just all the way from spirituality and multiple different things around cannabis.
They're really going to hear it, Chrissy. Don't scoop the lead.
That's true. That's true. So I say, let's roll into the interview. And in the end, we'll sync it up.
Have you ever met this funny reefer man?
Reefer man!
Oh, baby, reefer man.
Reefer man.
If he trades your dimes for nickels and calls watermelon pickles, then you know you're talking to that reefer man.
Reefer man!
Maybe start us off with telling us how you got into cannabis and then your personal experience with the flower to date and, you know, and where you are with it today because you have your brand. But how did you really get into the cannabis movement?
I first started smoking weed in Calgary in 1957, I think it was. 57. Wow. And at that time, no one knew what weed was. You know, you could smoke it anywhere if you had it and no one bothered you. In fact, when they would ask, you know, yeah, that smells different. You'd tell them, we used to tell them it was Italian tobacco, you know, and so I started in Calgary I'm a musician, you know, so it really helped with my music. It was a bass player, a jazz bass player, a Chinese guy by the name of Raymond Ma. He turned me on to a joint and a Lenny Bruce record at the same time, and to both of them. And he came from California, handed the joint in the Lenny Bruce record. I put the Lenny Bruce, the joint in my pocket.
Yeah.
And because I'd never smoked it, I never touched it. I was a little leery about it. I didn't know the etiquette. And yep. So he lit up one of his joints, and that was my first time I smoked, was in a jazz club. And I was listening to a tune by Ornette Coleman called Lonely Woman. I just remember it so clearly, and it changed my life, I think. And then I took the joint home, and I was still in school at the time, and I used to just smoke a tiny little toke, because I wasn't sure of the, you know, the dangers of it. And then I listened to the Lenny Bruce record over and over again, and the joint lasted for about a month, and then at the end of the joint, I ended up quitting school, and we got kicked out of Calgary and went to Vancouver, and I became a musician, and I just kept smoking, but I was a bodybuilder at the same time, so
oh, wow.
I wasn't into alcohol, you know, or anything that would hurt your body, you know, like I wasn't a druggie by no means. Yeah. The only thing I did was smoke pot, and then. You know, over the years, it's kind of proved out pretty good for me.
Yeah. Well, gosh, yeah. You have a whole brand around it for years to come. And the amazing part of it is, like, we've watched you grow and do all these things, starting with the comedy pieces and for music, and then getting into that 70s show. And you also were doing Joe Rogan. And so your brand's evolved even during times that were drugs on, like, even during times like during, like, the war on drugs and stuff like that, like, brand consistently kept moving through. Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, we went right through the whole thing. You know, I was in Vancouver, you know, like I said, we got kicked out of Calgary. Literally, the mayor, the chief of police, asked us to leave because we were playing for dances. We had a teen club. And I was always socially aware, you know. So when I was really young, I was 16, 17, we started a teen club. And legally, I had no idea how powerful that was, because it was a recognized social club. That and that's why we got asked to leave town.
Because you got kicked out because of a teen club. It was like Footloose is like the plot line.
What happened is that because we were the first rock and roll rhythm and blues band, we attracted all the crazies, all the hoodlums at the time, you know, the bad people.
Right.
And so because we were renting a Legion Hall, we had to shut it down at midnight. You know, midnight was the end, the last dance. And so then all this crowd of crazy teenagers would roam the city looking for things to do. Of course, they would go to parties and start fights. And I mean, it was just, it was like rock and roll, you know, back in the day. And so they couldn't shut the club down, but they could kick us out of town. And so the city asked us to leave. Now, we could have, if we had, now I would have had got a lawyer. They wouldn't have done anything like that. But at the time, it was like a chance to go somewhere else. Okay, let's go. And so we went to Vancouver. And then, that's where I came back once, you know, to Calgary and worked like a slave for about a year. You know, driving truck and doing all that stuff. But then we got called back to Vancouver. We put the band back together, and I haven't looked back since. I've been making a living playing music ever since.
That's incredible. So you've always been.
And that's, yeah.
You've always been a counterculture icon of.
Always.
Always.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
How do you feel about it now? Like, I mean, I'm just going to fast forward. There's a lot of things that happened between then and now, obviously.
Sure.
But if we're talking about cannabis, since you've always been on the counterculture side of things, how do you feel about it becoming more corporate?
I mean, I know people always, you know, they always go, oh, you know, big business is going to take over. That's why it's called big, because they know how to do things.
Yeah.
You know, and so when you reach that point, you know, then you've made it. So you either get with the big guys or you disappear, you know, or you become a mom and pop, whatever. No, I never look at anything in a negative manner. Them against us kind of thing. I never did. Like I go along with whatever is happening. You know, like when they kicked us out, like I said, when they kicked us out of Calgary, like I said, I could have fought. I could have said, no, and I would have won. And then what? I would have stayed in Calgary doing nothing. So what I do, I go along with it with whatever is happening. And so when you see corporations coming in and taking over, that's good. That's really good. Now, the only beef I have against legalization is that I love the way we had it legal. And I was one of the guys, there was me, Jack Herrera, and one other guy. No, well, actually, Jack and I, when it became medically legal, Jack called me up. We went to a doctor, and we had a letter from the doctor shrunk into a card, and it was the first medical marijuana card. Now, being medical to me made all the sense in the world. And this is what I'm advocating now, is that we had a system, you know, and then but the minute they try to make it or they made it recreational, then they're trying to capture. They're trying to capture it like the cigarette business or like the alcohol, you know, where it's like a sin, and they call them sin taxes, you know, where you're doing something wrong and therefore you should pay a ton of money to the government to let you continue doing something wrong, right. You know, and to me that's ridiculous. We had a whole plan with the medical, and that to me that's the way it should be, because you can't tax medicine the way you can tax other things. And when it's medical, it's tested. You know, you have to have it's medicine. So then you have to go through all the hoops, and, you know, to make it, you know, a good product, which I do with my product. That's what we do. We treat everything that comes out of our company like medicine. And so that's why we got such a good reputation. And I think in the end, that will prevail, you know, because the thing is about pot, man. You don't have to do anything with it. You just grow it. Pick it, dry
and it. Does it itself.
And then you smoke it.
I was going to ask a little bit about, and if it's okay if I ask this, because it's gone so corporate and you had this, the Operation Pipe Dream and Operation Headhunter that happened in 2003, when you guys were under investigation and all that stuff was happening and, you know, it wasn't legal at that point in time, you know, how did you feel about that? Like when corporate's coming in and you guys are, you know, they're pretty much doing what you're doing now, but in this under, you know, above ground economy, they call it now. You know, well, how did you feel about that? And you also spent time with what's his name? Oh my God, the Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah. You know, and then asked him to put in his, you know, I know. And then you're the one that said you should start writing your biography about it. Like you really are the catalyst for Jordan Belford to start that too. Like all of that story in one is like, is unbelievable to me. So how do you feel after being investigated and now the government's doing it legally?
Yeah, well, see, I always knew right from the beginning. Like I said, I'm a bodybuilder, right? So I'm a health nut too, you know. So I'm careful what I eat and how I look and everything. And so I knew right from the beginning that marijuana was a good product. You know, it was healthy. It was the only healthy thing around. And so, but it also made you relax, you know, and it takes your mind to another place. See, that's why I am where I am, you know, doing what I'm doing, you know, because I was a high school dropout, you know, my trade without music was driving truck. I was a truck driver. But the fact that marijuana works so well on the brain, see, it affects the brain and it makes you very creative. That's why the religious people, that's, you know, it started off as a religious substance way back, you know, the Bible talks about it, called a canna in the Bible. It goes way back. It goes 26,000 or 27,000 years ago in India. You know, it started there, and it started as a religious thing. When you see those Greeks, when they're doing the incense, you know, when the Greek Orthodox churches, when they're going up and down the aisles with the, you know, with the incense, they call it incense. It was marijuana back in the day. And then same as when Jesus, you know, when they brought their gifts, incense and myrrh, that incense was weed. So it was always been, it's always been a very, very special mind altering or mind expanding smoke or substance, whether you eat it or smoke it or whatever you do with it. So what happened with me, so I got that mindset. And so no matter what happened, I know I'm right. And I knew that they were wrong. In fact, Cheech and I, once we were on some panel and they're talking about the, you know, the war on drugs and everything else. Yeah. And so I just blurted out. I said, what if we're right? What if we're right and you're wrong? And they got a big laugh. Ha, 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 ha. It turned out we were right and then they were wrong. And so what happens? When your mind is affected like that, it makes you want to learn about things. You see, we wouldn't be doing this right now with a cell phone if it wasn't for marijuana, because that's what triggers Jobs and all those guys to come up with a computer. You know, they're sitting in the garage thinking, they're taking a toke and they go, hey, I got an idea. Why don't we do this? And next thing you know, look at us. Look at us now. We're talking, you know.
Yeah.
We're talking with a little handheld phone. I got my whole music library in this phone. I don't, you know. I mean, that's what marijuana has done to the planet. You see, and that's what we got to keep doing. We got to keep listening. We can't go back. You can't unlearn something. It's almost impossible. You know, unless you go into a coma and that. And so what I did. You know, with the when the prison thing come up, it was great. Yeah. To me, it was like another opportunity. I'm a writer, and so got a chance to go in 9 months in prison into experience that I look forward to that, man. You know, I mean, yeah, it was sad for my wife and family for a minute, but as soon as I was gone, she went on her own and she created a fortune with her holdings and everything. I mean, it was. That period of my life was probably the most productive period.
Wow.
Anyway, the whole thing about pot, and I was in there with a lot of potheads, but they were the ones that were running the prison. Like there's one pothead. Well, he was more of a, he had a pothead heart, but he was more, his problem was alcohol. His name is Eric Larson. He's a top caddy on the PGA tour right now. He's with Harris English, if you ever get a chance. But Eric used to cook every night for us, and us with like a elite group of people. And Jordan Belfort was in that group for a minute. He's the Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
But we had to fire him because he wouldn't play to our rules. He was like a Trump. Jordan Belfort is kind of like a Trump, you know, like elitist, you know. And the whole deal, when you ate, in our car, we called it the car. The only thing, they would cook, Eric and Andy would cook, but the new guy had to wash the pots and pans. And Belford wouldn't do it. He would hire another convict to wash his pots and pans for him.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Well, that broke the rule. So we kicked him out of the car. So Jordan wasn't allowed to eat with us anymore. But it was good because then he had time to write his book. But the whole point with marijuana, this is what I found. It affects the brain. It affects the brain, and it will enhance whatever you're interested in, whatever you're doing, be it writing a book, or be it doing art, or robbing a bank, or stealing mortgages, or from old ladies, whatever you're
whatever
doing,
it is.
It will do it. So that's. That's what happened with me with marijuana. It kept giving me smarts. Right. And so, think about it. Look at me. High school dropout. I ended up with a top 40 record on Motown.
Yeah.
You know, I was the first non-black guy to be on Motown with my white band from Vancouver. And then, the teacher and I played Carnegie Hall. You know, we've got, I directed, six movies. Directed, wrote yeah. and directed six movies. I never went to film school. I never went to music school. I still have my son now. He's a musician now. He still has to write charts for me because I still can't read music. But the marijuana... See, what marijuana does, what it did to me anyway, is that it gave me the smarts to recognize other people with smarts, and that's the key to everything. You know, when I met Cheech, I knew right away that this was because he was so talented, so funny, and so different.
Sounds like you kind of have this magical way of being of this go with the flow attitude that's enhanced with cannabis. And when they come together, you're just like, hey, I'm here. I'm open to everything that the plant has to give me. It sounds like you have a very spiritual connection with it.
Totally. No, the spiritual thing was very, very big. It's been all my life, by the way, you know. It's funny too. My wife, she's my partner, in comedy and everything else. But she's not. She never grew up the way I did. She's a talent in her own right. But my religious training, it for a lot of the hipsters, that's like they think, Chong's getting a little too well. Because what now when I do stand up, I don't just do bits because I don't have to entertain anymore. All I have to do is talk and people listen, and therefore I don't have to. It's not my job anymore to make anybody laugh, unless. Unless it comes into the thing. But my job really now, I think, is to educate, So if you want me on, ask me, how did you get to where you're at? I'll tell you. I'll tell you exactly what happened. When I was 8 years old, my mother had TB when I was 2 or 3. And so I never really saw my mother until I was 7, 8 years old. I mean, she was in the hospital and she was quarantined like we are now, only because the TB back in the day, they had hospitals in the boonies, out in the country. And we never went to her room. We had stood outside and she came to the window and we waved at the window. Until I was 7, 8 years old. That's all I saw of my mother. I kind of remember when I was a baby. But I was raised in we're very poor in Calgary. And we lived in like natives. I found out I'm 8% native and we were living like on the reservation. We had a house with no plumbing, no electricity, you know, just we had to go carry our water, chop our wood and everything else. The only entertainment was church and Sunday and Sunday school. That was the only entertainment. There's no television. We had a radio, but one station. And, you know, I'm a kid. And so I would go to Sunday school. And I loved Sunday school. I loved the stories. I loved it. And so I've been looking because they taught us one time in Sunday school, you know, God is everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so walking home across the field and down the road with my friends, I'm looking for God. I'm trying to see God. And something told me to look up. I looked up in the sky and there was a Milky Way, because we're in the country. The stars were so bright in Calgary, you could almost touch them. They were just bright. And the minute I said to myself, just to myself, where I want to see God, I want to see God. And then something just put my head up, and then I saw God. And I realized now what I really saw was that my ability to see and to understand and to process that meant I have a God app inside me.
Nice.
We all have. Yeah. We all are. That's who we are. Yeah. Now we're in this body now just to learn. Yeah. Because that's all you do in a physical plane, is you're always learning, you're constantly learning. And then the other thing, then I went to Bible camp. Again, you know, it was one of those looking for God. See, the minute you put out that request, it gets answered, because that's the only reason really why we're here, is so that we can get that awareness. Because once you get that awareness, then you're automatically you're pushed into the next grade, into the next level, and you keep getting pushed up and up and up and up, because you're ready for it. I was ready for it. And to this day, I mean, I'm looking around right now. But even though all this is mine, sort of, it's not mine.
Yes,
I'm just here temporarily. And we're on a voyage. We're all on a voyage. And so that you know, that kind of explains my attitude for the weed and. And being alone, being by yourself, it's because really when you're by yourself, then you're really with God. There's no one else. There's just you and God. Yeah. And it's one, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. I put the Father, the Son, and the Mom. I put that in there. The Father, the Son, and the Mom.
She's got to be there.
Yeah, right.
How do you feel companies and corporations can start bringing vibes of gratitude within the cannabis sector?
I think if you treat cannabis, well, you know, it's hard to say, because everybody has an individual reason, you know. It's hard to say without getting into someone else's karma, you know, growth, you know. That's why it's hard to, that's why they say judge not, you know, in the Bible, say judge not. And the reason is because once you start judging, then you're open to be judged, you know. You jump into that thing. So I really can't say, you know, about it. You know, predicting the future, it's, you know, I mean, all this is predicted, by the way, what's going on now. This was
it
all
could be
predicted.
Premeditated. Well, and also, I think the spiritual side, though, if we look at gratitude and giving all those things into the cannabis world and corporately, it it doesn't allow that person for choice too. So if I feel if they're putting a slant corporately on gratitude and spirituality, everyone has all different religions and all different type of spiritual beliefs that maybe they can't do that because it sways somebody to choose a specific lifestyle.
Maybe we
don't do that and let people choose their own path.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's what big business is. It's the ability to choose their own path. You know what this pandemic has done? It's brought the whole world under one umbrella of one problem, regardless of the government that you have. And then you realize that all governments are basically the same. The only difference is that now we're seeing them. Seeing it. You see the Trump and Putin, they're the same. Trudeau's different, you know. But they all have that sort of kind of fear, you know, the fear. I mean, they're a fear of being caught. And you know, what's so crazy is that, you know, this is what I saw in prison, too. You know, you don't need to steal anything. Everything is there. You can take whatever you want.
Can we ask you too, like, if somebody's never smoked a joint or never has ever consumed cannabis, do you have any advice that you tell somebody, like maybe how they can get into it, why they should get into it, you know, like
not even close.
Fair enough.
No, I'll tell you what, man, I tell people, you know, I get asked all the time, what should I do? I got cancer. What should I, blah, blah, you know, all that. Like you just asked, you know, first time, what would you suggest? I suggest say Google it, you know, learn everything you can. That's my wife is like that. No matter what, you know, she'll get on the phone, boom, 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 boom. And she gets the answers to everything. I'm old school. You know, I'll walk around in a daze, not knowing how to work my phone. But I tell people, Google it, you know, Google, research, do your research, and then come to me. First of all, research what you're doing, you know, what kind of cancer do you have? What's up with your life, you know? You know, there's a lot of times, you know, you can give the wrong advice.
Yeah.
I've done that. And I learned, you know. No, I just tell people, you know, go listen. That's it. The other thing too, you know, people say, you know, well, I did a movie about God, and they said, "Did you talk to God today?" I said, "I never talk to God. I only listen." And that's what I tell people. You know, just listen. Your heart will tell you. You know, your instincts will tell you.
Well, you're the talk of the town. You're the talk of the town.
Of course.
I would love to ask you, but you probably, I'd love to ask you if you were smuggling cannabis into jail during that time. But I don't know if you're going to tell us that.
There's a picture of you with the weed again. I love it.
Did anybody smuggle cannabis in during jail? Yeah.
They tried to bust me the whole time I was there. I think the second day I was there, I got offered a joint. But I was with my dog, Steve, and Steve is like protecting me. And so Steve knew right away they were trying to set me up. And so Steve told the guy, "Hey, take off, you know, get out of here." And I got what they would do. They would try to trick me into smoking. And then they would call me into this control for a pee test, drug test. They drug tested me constantly. They thought for sure I was, you know, and it was the opposite. Again, see, because I know marijuana is so good, the greatest thing about it is that it's not addicting. You don't have to smoke it. And so I went 3 years without smoking a drug. No, I got cancer because of that. You know, I got prostate cancer. But the fact, even to this day, if I have a reason not to smoke, I just won't smoke. Because being straight is another high.
Counterculture, alternative culture, subculture. Where does cannabis fit?
100% I would say that it fits in the counterculture spectrum. Why? Because counterculture within the cannabis world really defined a lot of other countercultures as well too. So why do I say that? It defined beatnik culture and the hippie culture and the civil rights movement. It influenced all of it. The jazz movement as well too, and jazz music culture. Cannabis had a little, it had its little hand in all of them. And so cannabis is 100% with the war on drugs that happened. It was not in the mainstream populace. And that's what counterculture is, right? It's going against the mainstream. So cannabis 100% used to sit in the counterculture world. And now it's in the mainstream world because of people like Tommy Chung, the hippie movement, civil rights, and the beatnik community as well too, and the beatnik culture.
So here's a thing where I agree that, but it should have never have been a counterculture. That's the thing that I find really, really interesting about cannabis. Cannabis was a part of our everyday lives. It had used as medicine from the beginning of time.
Yep.
And that, it should have never have been made illegal in the first place. The moment that it was classified as illegal, in particular in the United States, then what ends up happening is people who are using it didn't feel like that wasn't a just law. That is the thing that I find really interesting about it. It was something that was normal and every day. It was taken away from people because of racist policies.
100%.
Like, there's no two ways about it. That it was white individuals who saw both Mexican and Black Americans using this, and then they saw that as being a threat.
Yeah, and that lends into the civil rights movement. I think that cannabis plays a huge part in that. When we look at different sinks, I think if we can start one now, I would 100% say, right, like the jazz community. That's a big one. So many jazz musicians, Louis Armstrong, so many of them, Cat Calloway, all smoked reefers. It is embedded within music, within jazz cultures from like the 1920s and the 30s. And a lot of people didn't like any form of reefer, or they didn't smoke it and it wasn't acceptable. But within the jazz community, it was 100% acceptable.
It was just acceptable. Like, artists have a really interesting relationship with it. And especially the effects that it has on musicians is really interesting because it does slow down time.
Yes.
You can feel and you can experience the music in a different way. But even before that, the first reference of cannabis in a popular song, La Cucaracha, La Cucaracha.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. There's a whole thing. Cucaracha is like a cockroach, right?
Yeah.
There's a whole verse in it that describes this character, and it outright says marijuana. And again, like, marijuana, a completely derogatory term that was created in order to show a separation.
Right. It was a class identification.
It was a racist identification. Yeah. It kept people like separated. And it said that if you use this, then you are a part of other. And if you don't use this, you are good, God-fearing, high-achieving white people that'll do great things in this world. So then from the very beginning, it was created in order to create a division and a disproportionate enforcement to keep people down, which I think is like, you can't talk about cannabis in any which way, even if you're talking about the cultural significance of it and the sinks of it, without really acknowledging the impact and the PR that cannabis got by way of legalization and criminalization, I should say.
Like, started in the 20s and 30s, and then, in the 40s and the 50s, and you get this hippie culture that's embracing it. So first, the jazz community, with you're right, like, you have the Black community, you have the Mexican community that are embracing cannabis. And then you move later on where you start going into the hippie culture within the 60s. They start embracing it. And it's ironic because you get a Caucasian community that's like, I'm going to smoke pot now and be liberated. And so they start smoking pot, but then it becomes okay, because that really is the first movement of cannabis when it was popularized and okay in the mainstream to an extent. So you had the hippie culture, which was really fighting for civil rights and everything else too. I think they're all in the same community, to be honest. But then you're getting people within that movement that are white, that are aligning with these other cultures and these other beatnik cultures and things like that. And that are like, hey, I smoke pot and let's start free thinking. And then you get into the 70s and you get Nixon going, we're not doing this. War on drugs hit hard. And then we start getting into the conversations that we will talk about later too, is incarceration. Like, it's a heavy, 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 heavy topic, but it needs to be said. You cannot talk about cannabis without talking about incarceration.
It's true. You have to talk about the whole conversation because
you really do. Yeah.
It really, cannabis, as it has been defined within the politics and the laws of North America and arguably around the world, has really defined how people think of it.
Yeah.
And those laws were created by people who had an agenda. And that agenda was racist. And then we get to a time where cannabis was being sold in those jazz clubs.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And it was called the tea pads, and it was viewed as part of the lower class. That's where it kind of sat, and people didn't like it.
Yeah, they didn't. And you know, Louis Armstrong is one of those. Like, he's so notable in the jazz community within that era, but he also then got arrested for smoking a doobie outside of, it was called the Cotton Club, when he was doing a set break. And he wrote a letter to his manager, and the manager, in the letter, he writes, "I'm not so particular about having a permit to carry a gun. All I want is a permit to carry that good shit. You must see it, and that I have a special permission to smoke all the reefers that I want to, when I want to, or I just have to put this horn down. I can afford to be tense, fearing that any minute I could be arrested and brought to jail." Like, yeah, that's like all he wanted to do was smoke pot. Like, all Louis wanted to do is make some good music and smoke some good pot. There's nothing wrong with that.
He was really progressive because he understood the influence that he had as a popular musician of the day. And there's like so many others. Ella Fitzgerald, she smoked pot. Like, it was Cab Calloway. We mentioned it. He smoked pot. You know, everybody smoke weed. Gonna smoke weed every day.
Smoke weed every day.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with it because it is a benign plant that had been used as an integrated part of all of our lives. It didn't get criminalized in the States until 1937. So, I mean, there is jazz was happening in the 20s. You had prohibition was happening and this thing was popping. America wasn't even the first country to criminalize it, which I think is interesting into itself. And there's still many, many, many parts of the world that have these prohibitive laws in place. And so legalization just does not exist. It really only exists federally in Canada, Uruguay, Portugal. And then there's specific states have it, but it's not across the board. So there's a lot of people who are dealing with these unjust laws, artists being in particular, right? The Beat Generation, Jack Kerouac.
Yep.
They all used it. It helped them expand their minds and really was the influence of those leading generations going into the 60s when hippies just wanted to be free and to love, and they began to use cannabis recreationally. And I really think that it was the hippie movement that led the way for all of... There's a few things here, okay? I don't want to give... The hippie movement is really important because this is such a deeply racialized topic. Because white people started to smoke weed in mass amounts. And then that was like, they're like, oh no, I'm a good person. I shouldn't be going to jail. Whereas there's been generationally who had been subjected to unjust laws around cannabis before that.
Oh gosh, yeah. I think though, when we look at the hippie culture, they were all trying to work together, right? I don't think that, sorry, not stereotype. There is a comment to say though, that is a group of white people that it became accepted and more into the mainstream culture. You had Woodstock, you had all these things that people started doing, and it started to be a little bit more liberated when white people were doing it. But a lot of those white people that were smoking weed were also sticking up for all different types of cultures.
Oh yeah, because now they were starting to see the injustice.
The war in Vietnam. Yeah, they were, because they're working together, but it's just unfortunate that a group of white people, you know, you couldn't get a group of other people that are different cultures outside of being white, respecting them off the first place, smoking weed and having free thought and thinking it has to be someone Caucasian to do it. That's the really unfortunate
part. That's the unfortunate thing. Yeah. And that's kind of like, you have to have it when you're having a conversation about cannabis. I understand we're looking at the really pivotal moments that took cannabis from being a part of the counterculture.
That's one of the first sinks. Yeah. And I will say the hippie culture was one of the first sinks to move it in, unfortunately.
Well, they all kind of like led into each other. Yeah. So first you had like those fun little pop in jazz clubs. Everyone's going to go party.
Yeah.
And everyone's fraternizing with everybody else, having a grand old time.
But it wasn't really respected. So in 1936, there was a movie called Reefer Madness.
Oh yeah, Reefer Madness. Cannabis is a classic where they're showing about like white women smoking their joints, and then all of a sudden they want to be turning to prostitution. And
so I have a clip that has like, yeah, they created this hysteria around it and then this whole disinformation campaign to scare people. So I grabbed a clip of the one scene where they're smoking pot and
getting naked.
Not getting naked, but there is that scene. There's a couple scenes after they've smoked some doobies, and then they start getting a little kinky. And so they start smoking pot.
Hot.
And so they're all sitting down together. So there's a guy that's addicted to marijuana, because they're saying that marijuana is extremely addicting in this. And so there's a guy and a woman sitting at a table, and they're playing a piano, and they're both smoking pot.
Laughter.
I just think it's so dramatic. He's like, faster. It's like he's going into mania. It may pot look like it was manic. You would smoke it and you would be manic.
The cool thing about Reefer Madness is that it is the product of the work of a man who really understood the power of PR and propaganda.
Oh, 100%. Right? It was totally a campaign to discredit any form of cannabis, because they said that it made you crazy and psycho.
But Harry J. Anslinger, he is a man who had a deep and profound interest in criminalizing cannabis. And his work was, he understood the power of the media, and he devoted a lot of time in order to spread these messages out to the public. So he knew that if he get the mass behind him to really understand the dangers of it, then he could convince them to pass anti-drug prohibition laws. And he was successful. He was, if I have to look it up right now, a United States government official who served as the first commissioner of the U.S. Treasury Department's Federal Bureau of Narcotics during the presidencies of Hoover, Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy.
Wow.
So he was an incredibly influential person in the way that mass people assume cannabis is, and it is not based on fact. In fact, there had been studies that had been done previously that just were completely and absolutely ignored. Again, cannabis was something that was used in medications. Hemp fiber was used prolifically for clothing, for rope, for paper, you name it. If Canada is a country that was founded on the back of beer, then the United States was built with hemp.
With cannabis, yeah. But you also had people that, there's people that knew that was going on. And you started getting activists. So another person that really helped push it into the forefront and into mainstream pop culture was an American poet and writer and activist, cannabis activist, which is Allen Ginsberg.
Oh, Allen Ginsberg. He's from the Beat Generation.
Right.
He was cronies with Kerouac.
Yeah, he had a sign once, and we'll throw it in our Instagram as well too, that says, pot is fun. He was one of the first activists to really push it into mainstream and talk about it on a high level about why it needs to be legalized. So I think there's lots of people that we look at that are activists that help throughout that movement to push it into mainstream pop culture and to be accepted. And he was one of those. He's one of those catalysts along with Tommy Chong.
Here's a thing that I think is really interesting too, is they were both doing it. All press is good press at the end of the day. You know, the thing is about cannabis, you can't keep it down forever. Its history and its connection to humanity has been longstanding. And at some point it was going to come out in the wash. So now after Harry Anslinger is devoting all of his time to criminalize it, there's a whole lot of people that didn't even know that this thing existed, now know it exists.
Well, there's so many propaganda campaigns to go around it. So then we move into the 70s and Nixon and the war on drugs. That's really what started mass incarceration, with lots of people that were not white, that were Mexican, that were ethnic, that were brought into incarceration for smoking pot.
Yeah, 46%.
I looked up a stat. It said right now they're saying, though, I looked at the Pew Research Center, and the article was of this year, it's January 21st in 2020, and they're saying that 4 in 10 U.S. drug arrests in 2018 were possession sales of marijuana and manufacturing.
Yeah,
that's insane. Sorry, 4 in 10. That's crazy. But now you have a legalization, though. That's what's more insane, is that in 2018, you're getting all of these states that are legalized, but you're still getting incarceration for something that is legalized in governments that are making millions and billions and trillions at points of selling cannabis, and people are in jail.
We have the opportunity. We have the opportunity to do things better in our world right now. And we know, unfortunately, the way it's worked for centuries or decades is that appropriation is a real thing. So for years and years and years, growing, selling, smoking, they were associated with people, and they were disproportionately incarcerated and charged with offenses with it, and they were sent to jail. They still sit in jail. And now you have the whole green rush that's happening, and who is profiting of that, and who is not a part of that? They don't even have an opportunity. Black men and women, Mexican men and women, who are suffering under the tyranny of unjust drug laws, are unable to participate in the green rush that's happening in the United States. I will say even in Canada. And I think that's going to be the next major conversation that we're going to have, because reparations need to be taken place.
100%.
With minimum drug sentences. Things.
Yeah.
Cannabis. So cannabis is classified as a Schedule One drug.
Right.
And a Schedule One drug means that there is absolutely no medicinal value to it, of which we know is wrong. Which takes me to a major sink. Medical use of cannabis. Because at this point now, we had been conditioned for years and years and years to think that if you smoke the wacky tobacco, you're going to do exactly what that man does in
Well,
Reefer
there was
Madness.
No research. There was little to
There's
none research.
There's tons of research.
Well, there wasn't back then, though. Dude, that's what I mean. Now, it's a very different conversation.
When medicinal laws were coming in place, there is a fantastic study that I love. Fantastic study that was done by the Canadian Supreme Court. And it was one, at the time, it was one of the most comprehensive modern studies in the uses and effects of cannabis on people. Now, with these prohibitive laws, it made it difficult to do other studies. But at the same time, once they decriminalized, I'm just using this sweepingly, once cannabis was decriminalized and people were able to get a prescription from it from their doctors, then it's going out in all the press. We now know that there is a medicinal value to this very natural substance. And it starts to shift the way that people think about it. Now the conversation stops being about the lazy stoner hippies and the potheads. And it now starts legitimizing it as something that has a benefit. And so now you have people who are going out to get licenses to use it medically. Pretty much anybody could get it. And they're using it. And they're using it socially, publicly. They're starting to talk about it now without shame. They're less worried about the stigmas associated with it because now it's validated. They can use it. And so I think that making cannabis a medicinal treatment helped to pave the way towards recreational legalization.
There's lots of other sinks, like even within medicinal, and then we look at other things, like we go back to music. Mm-hmm. You know, we forgot about the hip hop community. Because of the war on drugs, you know, we had this amazing sound, which is hip hop, that came out of it. One of the reasons why it came out of it. And it was part of that comes in hand with cannabis as well, too.
It does. Bob Marley, I mean, he's not hip hop. Bob Marley.
Oh, my gosh.
Sung about it openly and really helped to really put it on a lot of people's radars. And also,
well, that's another part of that. You know, the reggae community is another sink within it, within music. You know, we have hip hop, jazz, and reggae.
This is not like Cole Porter's Tin Pan Alley. This is not Britney Spears pop music. These are music of people who are either are part of a religious subculture, like Bob Marley is a Rastafarian.
Yeah.
Or they're part of a counterculture of individuals that live in mainstream, but not on the same level as everybody, because there's not the same level of equality for everyone. Then it was our hip hop pioneers, our jazz musicians, our beatniks, everybody.
They started it.
Who were doing the grassroots, forgive me for my puns, who were doing their grassroots movement, including references to cannabis in their music by way of slang. Which is why I think we have so many words for it, because we had to subversively talk about this for so long.
Yeah, because it wasn't mainstream then.
It wasn't mainstream, but yet the message still had to get out. The form of protest was so
perfectly integrated within our pop culture music life.
Well, we look at Snoop. That was a big one.
Well,
Snoop is a huge, not a song, but as an artist. Cypress Hill. Did you know Cypress Hill smoked the first joint on Saturday Night Live?
That's controversial.
Yes.
Because they were told not to do it, but that is the act of protest. That is the pushing. That is the best thing when musicians are able to step outside of the box and to push the way society
And now
thinks.
We're seeing that. We're seeing Miley Cyrus at the MTV Music Awards lit up a joint on stage. There's so many artists that are lighting up joints and making it acceptable. So we're getting all these people that are, you know, like we have Dr. Dre had a whole album called The Chronic. Like all of these things are, you know, being on High Times, like being on the cover of High Times.
Well, High Times as a magazine
is a huge sink of two that brought in cannabis into the mainstream culture. Like there's all these little, this is the one thing about cannabis that is so amazing is that there's so many sinks. That's why I think it's so pivotal within all countercultures. It's one of the counterculture that puts its finger and its hand into all the other ones. And I find that really interesting because we notice as we talk that countercultures are getting influenced by other countercultures and they work together at times. We see that. Yeah. But cannabis as a plant and a flower really, to me as a substance, is so interesting that it's changed people's mindsets or it's pushed movements into certain ways. People can agree with me or not, but I feel that it might be one of those catalyst moments that helped change. And who knows, maybe we're going through another, you know, resurgence or a new movement because pot's legalized now.
And then we go into film and television. Chrissy, yeah. Take me on a journey, Chrissy.
Well, the funny thing that I always look at film and television. So when you think of someone who smokes weed, mm-hmm. not now, back in the day, what did you think?
Oh, I'm going to sound like an ass.
No, it's just, it's a concept though.
I thought of people who smoked weed. I thought of it as lazy, young, white guys with bad skin who were, I just thought of like, I thought about the classic stoner.
Right.
But truthfully, the stoners, now I look at it and I'm like, the stoners were the ones that pushed it through. The stoners were the ones that were, they were our modern hippies who were fearless. They were the ones that kind of brought it to everybody's consciousness. But the only thing was, is that our own biases that, you know, made us think that those people were less than or they weren't as smart, which is absolutely not true.
Back in the day, you had this stoner mentality that they were dumb, they were lazy, they were uneducated. This concept of the stoner was always really negative.
Always really negative.
Really, it was. It was really, really negative. And then it started, right. And it doesn't mean it's right, but that was the media and that's how film portrayed it. We had that 70s show that had it, you know, you had the weed circle, Cheech and Chong, still Chommy Chung in them, had that mentality. They played off it, which is not a bad thing. It was totally a stereotype that was created around it, but everybody accepted it. And the stoner did bring it in, but it was always played as this kind of guy that didn't really give a crap in context. So you had all these movie references, but now when you look at people, when we look at pot, that is not even on TV anymore. That stereotype is gone. I wonder when that little shift happened. And it started, I would imagine, with parts of states and countries like Canada being legalized. That mentality shift. So we had things like, there's movies, for example, in Ted, and I'm going to show you this one, because Ted's like one of those great movies. Love Ted. And it's so funny because you have a little
by Seth MacFarlane with the Randy little stuffed teddy bear.
Right, the stuffed teddy bear. So you make this super acceptable when you have a little teddy bear getting high. Like, to me, that's hilarious.
Everybody gets high.
Right. So this is the clip.
Even the bears.
Right.
Oh, hey, listen, try this. I told my weed guy to step it up and he gave me that.
What is this?
It's called Mind Rape. It's actually pretty mellow.
Doesn't sound very mellow.
Well, he only had three other batches. Gorilla Panic, They're Coming, and something called This Is Permanent. Come on, spark it up. There you go. You got it.
Get
Nice. Good, huh?
Good job.
Yeah.
Take pride in that.
So, and lots of other films too, and TV shows, like that 70s show really welcomed in the stoner circle. Even mm-hmm. though I believe during the show, they never showed them actually smoking weed.
Yeah, they did.
I didn't think they did.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Oh, I just thought they just showed a smoke like cloud around them. I know that, but I don't think they showed them ever smoking a joint or a bong.
I have memory of them smoking it, but I
haven't watched it. That's what I thought too. But when I rewatched it, I never actually saw them smoking a joint or a bong. It was just the concept of it and the circle around it.
And then to go back, they didn't smoke on the show because it was the circle was their creative solve on the network's rules.
Right.
So they weren't allowed to show teenage drug use.
Right. For sure. And I think that's a good place to leave it, Marie.
Also, if you want to help support us and do more shows, you can check us out on our Patreon.
Yes.
The link is on our website. And you can reach us on social.
Yeah. You can go to AltPop at AltPop Repeat. We're pretty much anywhere at AltPop Repeat.
Yeah. We really like it. It's a good name.
It is. Until our next sync.
Bye.
Bye.
We love you.